Volatility, thy name is Bitcoin, but in futures may lie your salvation. May being the operative phrase there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, 11 December. Glad to have you along, everybody, as we always are. We begin the program today where we ended it on Friday, which, if you somehow happen to have missed it, was on Bitcoin, specifically the brand new, as of last night, Bitcoin futures market. Interest, if I may be permitted some degree of understatement, was high. The Chicago Board Options Exchange stopped trading in Bitcoin futures a couple of times as prices went up and then up some more. Why, though, the demand for Bitcoin futures when it is such a bubblicious commodity? Marketplace's Ryan Kailath gets us going.
First, a quick refresher. What are futures contracts again?
Best example I can come up with. I'm a farmer.
That's Bill Monick, not a farmer, actually a finance professor at Case Western. But go on.
I'm a farmer. My corn is in the ground. It's growing. But my crop won't be ready for 3 more months.
And in 3 months, anything could happen. The price of corn could go way up, way down. There's a lot of uncertainty and risk. What if he could agree on a price for the corn now?
A futures contract would allow me to do that.
Same idea with Bitcoin futures, Monick says. Take some of that risk and uncertainty out of trading the volatile cryptocurrency. And it's not just the price certainty that helps. Craig Perung at the University of Houston says futures exchanges like Cboe introduce much-needed transparency and regulation.
And that's going to make it more attractive to institutional players.
A.K.A. Wall Street. Your banks and hedge funds and other big investors have largely shied away from risky Bitcoin plays. But a futures market is safe, familiar ground for them.
They're used to using these futures markets. They're comfortable with the regulatory framework, and so they're much more likely to participate in this forum than they would be in the other Bitcoin trading venues.
Futures trading is subject to extensive safeguards and surveillance, Perung says, that can help prevent some of the price manipulation people worry about with Bitcoin. Ironically, he says a futures exchange will also make it easier to short Bitcoin or bet that the price will go down, which could drive the price down, restoring some sanity to the Bitcoin market. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
I said bubblicious. I'm sticking with it. The EPA has announced 21 new Superfund sites. Getting on that list means federal officials oversee the cleanup. But the news does come as the Trump administration is taking less action overall on pollution penalties and enforcement. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
One of the new Superfund sites is a shuttered fertilizer plant in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Chemical byproducts from the plant are still stored on site in giant mounds. That can create toxic runoff when the area gets hit by big rainstorms or hurricanes.
With every inch of rain, there's 9 million gallons of this, wastewater that's created.
Aisha Gray is director of the Grand Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve, right next to the site. She says spills from it have entered local watersheds, like in one incident.
I think they had over 100,000 fish that were killed.
She welcomes the Superfund designation.
It is something that we have been wanting for a long time.
Claudia Persico at the University of Wisconsin-Madison studies Superfund cleanup. She says the program has big benefits to human health.
It reduces not only the risk of cancer, but also the risk of learning disabilities because the stuff can actually potentially affect brain development.
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has promised to take the agency, quote, back to basics, focused on clean air and water, not on climate change. But LG Holstein with the Environmental Defense Fund says Pruitt's Superfund site expansion may be lip service.
That there's going to be greater attention paid to cleaning up some of these sites. But there's no actual additional money, and there may well be much less money before they're finished.
He points to the Trump administration's budget proposal, which calls for a 30% cut to the program. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Today's macroeconomic story comes to us from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and the news that the government there is going to reverse a decades-old ban on movie theaters. Yes, going to the movies is fun, but that is not what's going on here. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
There's a lot of pent-up demand in Saudi Arabia for entertainment. In fact, Saudis will even travel to another country to watch a movie. Egyptian film critic Joseph Fahim sees them all the time in Bahrain, Dubai.
Of course, I've seen lots of Saudi friends who go watch movies and sit over a drink.
Speaking on Skype, Fahim says once Saudi cinemas are open for business, they'll be a major force.
This will be probably the second or third biggest market in the region.
The Saudi government estimates the new cinema business will create more than 30,000 jobs by 2030. Marwan Qaidi teaches global media and communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
Cinemas are expected to contribute about $24 billion to the Saudi economy. They're thinking about 300 cinemas, 2,000 screens.
The movie theater openings are part of a bigger government plan to make the Saudi economy less dependent on oil by boosting Saudi consumer spending on things like entertainment. Jerry Firestein at the Middle East Institute says cinemas are just the beginning.
It goes across the full range of activities, not only theme parks, but also developing the museums.
Firestein says U.S. companies are watching this, and he wouldn't be surprised to eventually see U.S. theater chains and even Disney World in Saudi Arabia. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, same old, same old. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a World Trade Organization meeting going on this week in Buenos Aires, in the course of which today, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer complained too many countries aren't following the rules on global trade. A lot of relatively wealthy countries, he said, are getting unfair advantages by being classified as emerging economies. Analysts reading between the lines here took that as a swipe at China, a country for which President Trump, as we've been reporting, does not have a lot of economic love. However, after the president's visit last month, China announced it's going to ease up on restrictions on foreign companies doing business there, including financial services, which is a sector worth, as you might imagine, trillions of dollars. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak has more on that from Shanghai.
Here's why President Trump says China is not playing fair when it comes to trade. Chinese companies can, for the most part, operate freely in the U.S. But when American businesses come to China, there are government restrictions. Thomas Chong has worked in asset management, pension, and life insurance in Asia for more than 17 years.
In China, the insurance industry was very restrictive to foreign investors in that if you have more than 25% foreign share ownership, your ability to grow your business is subject to getting one city license at a time.
He's now the head of Principal Financial Group's North Asia division. When his company came to China in 2005, like other foreign investors, it was limited to a minority stake in a joint venture. The Chinese government has been relaxing these rules, but American companies complain it's been too slow. Then, just after Trump left Beijing last month, China announced that foreign companies will have even more control. Here's the Chinese Vice Finance Minister Zhu Guangyao telling journalists that China plans to get rid of limits on foreign investment in Chinese banks, although he did not say when it might happen. Many analysts say the Chinese have made a big concession to the U.S., perhaps to avoid any retaliation from Trump. But it's also because China is worried about its bad debt. Brock Silvers is with the investment advisory group Kaiyuan Capital based in Shanghai.
Banks and related financials have very problematic balance sheets, and these reforms seem a bit like an invitation to foreign capital to come help bail out China's credit bubble.
China will also allow foreign investors to own up to 51% of Chinese securities firms, fund managers, futures, and insurance companies, and eventually the foreign firms will be able to run their own operations here. American investors have welcomed these reforms, but they're not fighting to get in. Silver says some long-established Chinese players are now too big to beat.
If you look at the lending market in China, it's already quite crowded and competitive, and I don't see an obvious opening for foreign firms and capital.
And China still has many other controls on foreign banks and investors. That's because it's still a developing country, says Lian Ping. He's the director of industry research at the China Banking Association. He tells me that Chinese banks are still playing catch-up to the U.S. in terms of how they're run and how they manage risks. So he says China needs American expertise to help make Chinese banks more competitive. But what would it take to really shake up the industry? Again, Thomas Chong of the Principal Financial Group.
I think what would really be a game changer for the whole industry is when the market opens up to allow Chinese investors to invest globally without restrictions.
China is still a long way from that, but Chong says the latest announcement of more foreign control is an important step. He's just not convinced that his company needs to renegotiate its joint venture deal, in part because business is so good that his company has hired more technical support and experts back in the U.S. So Americans should cheer on their businesses in China, because if they do well here, they could create more high-paying jobs in the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The American West is known, among other things, for having a whole lot of open spaces that can make for some great vistas, also some amazing road trips, unless you happen to be driving an electric vehicle and there are miles to go before a charge. Sales of EVs are climbing. They will be perhaps half the global market by the middle of the century, according to forecasters. But here, in the present day, charging stations, and more accurately, the lack thereof, is still a big problem in this transportation revolution. Dan Boyce with the public media collaboration Inside Energy reports on an agreement between Western states to try to calm what is known as range anxiety.
A ribbon cutting in downtown Denver gives a snapshot of electric vehicle charging in the U.S. The event's called Ride into the Future. Several car companies have EVs here for people to test drive around the block. There are electric bikes, too. But the real highlight is the unveiling of the first electric car fast charger in Denver's Lodo neighborhood.
Is this not a really good-looking DC fast charger?
Cindy Patton runs parking and mobility services with the city of Denver. There are more than 150 chargers citywide already. She paints this new installation as a win against climate change. All of this to launch what's really the equivalent of a single gas pump. Because in 2017, charging EVs can still be a hassle, especially on road trips and especially in the West, where populations are sparse and highways are long. At Denver's popular 16th Street Walking Mall, it doesn't take too long to find people interested in the idea of owning an electric car.
Yeah, it's Mike Unger.
My name is Aaron Hackman.
They've both thought about it, but can't quite get over the idea that they might be stranded without power.
If I was going to, you know, drive to Kansas City, I don't know that I would feel comfortable doing that in an electric car.
If there's not a way for me to charge my car, then I'm stuck, right?
The industry is trying to combat this perception. Companies are building faster chargers and cutting deals with the likes of grocery and hotel chains to get them installed. Royal Dutch Shell, the oil company, recently announced it's putting in chargers at its gas stations in the UK. In the American West, state governments are stepping in to install them.
We're going to start out at every 50 miles.
That's Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, touting a new plan to put charging stations along interstates in seven western states from Montana down to Nevada.
So that people, no matter where they're driving, can feel pretty comfortable that they're not going to run out of fuel, as it were.
Officials hope to have this western charging network up and running in 3 to 5 years. Sam Ori with the University of Chicago's Energy Policy Institute says range anxiety is hurting the spread of EVs. And while the industry is pushing out more chargers, it's also working to make the batteries in the cars last longer on a single charge, as much as 300 miles or more. But Ori says doing so can affect the biggest factor holding back electric cars, the purchase price.
As you start to build in range or build in more battery capacity to extend the range, the vehicle gets more expensive and the economics get a little more challenging.
Electric cars generally start between $30,000 and $40,000, and incentives already exist to bring that price down in many states. Still, research from Ori's Institute shows oil would have to shoot up to more than $200 a barrel to make an electric car a better financial deal than a similar gas car. Ori says without serious policy penalizing carbon emissions, like higher gas taxes, without that, EVs will remain at a disadvantage for a long time. Until then, Ori says,
there's a market out there for people who don't care as much about whether or not they break even over the life of the vehicle.
Including himself, Ori has an electric car, and it wasn't necessarily the best economic move, even if there are a lot more ribbon cuttings for new charging stations. In Denver, I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, you know, in those days, there wasn't too much rapport between engineering and medicine.
The future of something called physicianeering. Straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 56 points today, 0.2%, 24,386. NASDAQ added 34, about 0.5%, 68.75. S&P 500 up 0.3%, 26.59. Everybody's kind of waiting around, waiting to see what the Fed's going to do in its meeting the next couple of days. Told you about Bitcoin futures today. That excitement boosted companies in some way connected to the cryptocurrency. Overstock.com, one of the first online retailers to accept Bitcoin, saw its shares up 22% today. Meanwhile, Riot Blockchain, which invests in the tech behind all those Bitcoin transactions, it's called blockchain, share price up 45%. Yes, you heard that one right. Apple is buying Shazam. You might have heard that one. Apple shares up 1.9% today. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at Marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. President Trump said this last month, quote, "In the history of our country, no president during their entire term has cut more regulations than we have cut," end of quote. That, according to some tallying by Bloomberg News, is not entirely true. Alan Levin wrote the story. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's interesting that you point this out at a time when the administration is still, in a lot of ways, looking for its first big legislative win.
I mean, first, it needs to be said that the Trump administration is very aggressively going after regulations. There's no doubt about it when you look at climate change and financial oversight and that sort of thing. But it was very important for the president to cite high numbers. He's made some pretty dramatic claims in recent weeks. Part of it is it needs to be viewed through this prism of them not having this big legislative victory yet. Mm-hmm.
One of the things you point out, actually, just to that question of the Trump administration actually going after regulations very hard, because they are, and elections have consequences, as OMB Director Mick Mulvaney said the other day. Part of what's happening here in the regulatory space is the question of tone. It's people being appointed to these jobs who are interested in whatever their regulatory agency happens to be, doing less of what that agency does. The EPA, for one, is the big example.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no doubt that that is occurring. One of the things I did is look at the number of regulations that have been reviewed by the arm of the White House that sort of has a final sign-off on regulations. And they're down substantially from prior years. It was about one quarter as many as the Obama administration did a year ago during the same period.
You point out in this piece that there are laws on the books designed to prevent regulations from coming and going too quickly. In other words, designed to maintain some kind of regulatory stability.
Yeah, absolutely. Both Democratic and Republican administrations in the past three or four decades have imposed a lot of these rules. They're designed to ensure that a rule has benefits that pay for the costs of the rule. The process is designed to move slowly so that we don't act precipitously and put something into effect that we might regret. But what that means is it's been very difficult for the Trump administration to actually kill existing rules. And so if you take out of the picture rules that Congress killed, which is 15 so far this year, the Trump administration itself has only gotten rid of perhaps about a dozen existing rules by most counts.
Just to dig into this a little farther, if they're not actually killing regulations already on the books, what are they doing with them? I guess it's a process question, right? What's the process steps that they're taking?
Well, I'll give you some of the examples of the claims that they made. a year and a half ago, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it was halting work on a long and contentious regulatory action to oversee runoff from forest roads so mm-hmm. that loggers cut or whatnot. They decided there was no need to go forward with it, but it was not officially taken off the books. So this spring, the administration killed that off and declared it as a victory of deregulation.
Alan Levin at Bloomberg News in Washington, writing most recently about regulations in this economy. Alan, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
If, by the way, government regulations are your thing, we have a podcast that is right up your alley. It's called The Uncertain Hour. Season 2 is underway right now. It is all about regulations in this economy. Check it out. Without getting too far into the how of it, by which I mean the politics of repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act or not doing that, one of the truisms of the American healthcare economy is that if we could make it more efficient, more effective per dollar spent, that would be a good thing. Texas A&M University is working on that by doing something a little bit different with medical education, integrating engineering into its health-related disciplines. From Dallas, KERA's Lauren Silverman has that story.
In the late 1940s, two Canadian physicians wanted to see if they could use electrical pulses to restart a human heart. They had the medical knowledge, but they needed an engineer. Only problem was...
Well, you know, in those days, there wasn't too much rapport between engineering and medicine.
That's Jack Hobbs, the electrical engineer who helped create the pacemaker more than half a century ago. He's speaking in a 1984 interview with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
The medical people didn't know the potential of engineering to assist them, and we knew nothing at all about the medical problems.
In the decades since, the silos separating engineering from medicine have started to break down. You can see the collaboration at startups like Dallas-based Mednoxa. Engineer and former Marine Eric Fry shows off his product, which wouldn't exist without cross-discipline partnerships.
Okay, what is this on the table?
These are prototypes of the core of our technology, which is a bandage that generates oxygen from the chemical decomposition of hydrogen peroxide.
Basically, it's a really fancy Band-Aid. There are tiny channels inside that produce air to help wounds heal. Mednoxa is seeking FDA clearance to sell the bandages by prescription and over the counter. After Fry came up with the idea, he needed to put together a team. People who speak the language of medicine, plus people who speak the languages of engineering and design. But what if doctors or engineers were bilingual, so to speak, from the start? That's the idea behind a new program at Texas A&M University.
InHealth is a new initiative, the first in the country, in fact, that will integrate engineering into all colleges that are a part of the healthcare enterprise.
Roderick Pettigrew is the doctor/engineer leading the charge. Texas A&M recruited him from the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. Pettigrew says the curriculum will challenge students in nursing and medicine, pharmacy, and public health to think about better ways to diagnose, treat, and prevent disease while they're in school.
And from this engineering-based mindset, a mindset that we call physicianeers, should emerge a group of students who are better equipped and more efficient in problem solving.
For instance, students in the School of Medicine would graduate with an MD and master's in engineering in 4 years. Eric Fry, who created those smart Band-Aids, says giving doctors the tools to think like engineers could be valuable.
I think the more cross-training you have, the better it enables all that collaboration that you need.
Just a handful of students are part of the pilot program at Texas A&M now, with plans for several dozen to be part of the first class in 2019. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I honestly can't decide how I feel. The British newspaper The Telegraph reports that Marks & Spencer, a big higher-end retailer over there, has started selling avocados that don't have a pit in them. They look a little bit like pickles, actually, so not all that big. Don't taste all that good, apparently, either. And finally, somehow, it's just not right. Also, one more thing I forgot. Do we really need pitless avocados? I don't think we do. All right, Dow up 56 today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ added 34, 0.5%. S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.3%. Fed starts its two-day meeting on interest rates tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Haley Hirschman, and Daisy Palacios. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.